Okay, hello, welcome everybody. Thanks so much for coming out today. My name is Kimberly Emery. I'm the Assistant Dean here for Pro Bono and Public Interest, and delighted to welcome you to what I hope is now our annual panel on public interest law in the private law firm setting. And I can tell you, after being here for as many years as I've been here, and I won't tell you how many, that you recognize two things. One is that the need for services out there in the world, and we've all seen this, is vast and just pretty much unmet. I mean, there's endless needs. And the other thing that you come to realize over time is that, you know, people are basically good. People want to respond. People get caught up in their own lives, but when there's a need, we can see that, for example, after Hurricane Katrina, people poured out, found time to volunteer. And so what you really need to do is connect that vast need with those people who really, if you ask them and you package it right, will be willing to help. And I think that's really what my job is about here at the law school, and that's really what Scott does at Dewey LeBoeuf, is you find ways to take those public sector needs and package them and present them to private firm lawyers in a way that they will follow their natural inclination to help. So that's a little bit of what today's panel is going to be about. We have wonderful speakers who come all the way from D.C. and New York, and Scott is going to introduce those to you in a moment. But let me introduce Scott Fishen. He is a 2003 grad of the law school and went out to the private law firm sector and practiced for a couple years at what was then LeBoeuf Land, now Dewey LeBoeuf, and then became their first manager of corporate and social responsibility, which really means, as I said, packaging up pro bono and public service needs in a way that his private attorneys, associates, and partners will accept those and work on those and give their time, treasure, and talent to those. And he will tell you some of the stats, but it's really quite phenomenal, the push that Dewey has made and the results they've been able to have. So with no further ado, let me turn it over to Scott with great thanks for being back here again.
Well, thank you. I'm Scott Fishman. I was the manager of corporate social responsibility for the LeBoeuf Land, and as of January 1, we are now I'm a director of pro bono. So now you actually know what I do. Basically, as Dean Emery said, I direct our pro bono legal services work. And I did litigate for a few years in the New York office with the firm before the merger. And the purpose of the discussion today really is, rather than discussing what Dewey LeBoeuf does in the pro bono sector, is rather to talk about what would interest folks who are interested in pro bono work but have decided to go into the private sector with their careers. So, talking about people who have an interest in doing public interest work, but wanted to do it while at a private law firm. And I was in that boat when I was in law school. I was a teacher before I was a lawyer. I was very much interested in the public sector. I knew I wanted to help people in need, but I had already decided that I was not going to go into the public sector with my career. So I was trying to find a way to match those interests. And there is a way to do it, and it is through pro bono work at a law firm. But what I wasn't able to do at that point was I didn't know what to search for. Because when I went on websites, and I know this is going to be very shocking to all of you, it seems that they all love pro bono work. And they all said the same about pro bono work. And we all like to address the concerns of individuals and communities in need. And all of our attorneys are encouraged to do wonderful work for those in need. And we give some sort of credit for it. And then they would have a case blurb or two, kind of like what we do on our website too. You know, but what is it that law firms do with pro bono work specifically? And more importantly, in the recruiting process, what is it that I would need to ask in order to distinguish between law firms with respect to how much they encourage pro bono work? Do they just allow it Do they embrace it? And what's the difference? What are the factors that I need to consider? Because we're lawyers, we love factor tests. That's what we do best. We have steps that we need to consider. So when we're balancing our wonderful factors, what are the factors that we need to decide? We need to consider for deciding what firm to go to or which pro bono work. So what we're doing today is discussing some of those factors, and then we're also discussing from the perspective of a public interest organization, why is it that law firms are even in this game to begin with? What is it? Why are law firms interested in pro bono work? And why is it important to the public interest community that they are interested in pro bono work? So we're going to talk about all of that today, and we're going to talk through, hopefully not through me, but rather through a wonderful panel of guests that we've assembled. We have four attorneys from the law firm, two from the New York office, two from the Washington office, and we have our star public interest advocate here from the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under law. So instead of me introducing each of them, I'm just going to ask that they introduce themselves, what office you're from, what practice group, if you're with the firm, and a little bit about yourself.
Hi, everyone. My name is Eridania Perez. I'm a partner in the litigation department of Dewey & LaBeouf. And I've been with the firm since 1999, since I graduated from law school. I attend the Rutgers Law School in New Jersey.
Just one quick example of a pro bono case or a type of work that you do, a one-liner.
I do a lot of the VAWA petition cases, the immigration cases. VAWA is... Under VAWA, women who are the victim of domestic violence, undocumented women who are married to legal or citizens of the U.S. but are being subject to domestic abuse, the government allows them, there is a procedure by which the government allows them to proceed with their legal case, with their legal status case, without the assistance of the abusive husband. So I do a lot of those cases. I also, one of the main cases, it was a major impact litigation that I worked on last. It was also immigration. It was about Hodo. I don't know if you guys heard of, in Texas, the Hodo case, which is where the firm was co-counsel with the ACLU on challenging the detention of minors in prison-like conditions. Basically, children of undocumented immigrants were being detained at this facility called Hodo, which was a prison. And kids were forced to dress as prisoners with the green, I think they had like a green uniform. They slept in cells. They had a schedule. You have to be in the cell a certain time, could not come out. There was no schooling provided for the kids, no playing time. So that was one of the most recent ones I worked on and one of the ones that I felt happier about. So.
Hi, my name is Delia Patterson, and I'm in the D.C. office of Dewey & LaBeouf. And I graduated from law school in 2005 and summered at Legacy Dewey. And I did not graduate from this fine institution. I went to Georgetown Law School.
But we love you anyway.
Yes, hopefully. I do legal intake where we just go in, and like one of the most recent ones that I'm involved with now is the housing clinic one that Legacy LaBeouf brought over, and I just received training, and I do like sort of like the bite-sized legal work where you go in and you do intake for, 4 hours on a Friday. I also am a court-appointed special advocate in Maryland, and I have been a volunteer before law school in 2002. I did that work, and I was doing a lot of the, like, going to court with the abused and neglected child that I was responsible for then, and, taking time off to go to, meetings, educational meetings, meeting with the child social worker and doing all this stuff. And the partner that I worked with said, "What are you doing? What's going on?" And he's like, "This is pro bono. Like, let's start a matter number, and you need to get credit for this. You're doing this on your own free time." And that's the work that I do mostly, is working with this foster child.
Hi, I'm Nancy Anderson. I'm the pro bono counsel, senior counsel with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. We are a national civil rights organization founded 45 years ago by President Kennedy. We're up in Washington, D.C. And our work is primarily class action race discrimination litigation and also impact transactional work. We do some public policy work and other non-litigation work. And we co-counsel with volunteer law firms on everything that we do, which is why I'm here to talk about law firms, because we work with all the big firms all across the country. And my job is to persuade these fine folks and other ones just like them to work for us for free. And so I'll tell you more about what I do later.
Hi, my name is Luis Parada. I work in the Washington, D.C. office of Dewey and LaBeouf. I am an associate in the public international law practice of the group. I work mostly on boundary disputes between countries, and I find my work very fulfilling and rewarding, but pro bono is really what I enjoy doing just as much. I was a lateral associate coming into Legacy LaBeouf 4 years ago, and my involvement in pro bono started in my previous law firm, where I was working representing students, high school graduates who were wanting to go to college here in Virginia, but because of their immigration status being in limbo, they were being denied admission by state colleges like UVA and others. because they were deemed to be undocumented. And when we looked into their cases, they were really not what people would refer to as illegal aliens. They were just in the long process that it takes for them to get their permanent residency. One of our clients was brought to the U.S. when he was 3 years old, and it took 14 years for the federal government to process the asylum application for his family. In the meantime, they had a work permit. They had Social Security numbers. They were paying taxes. But yet, when this kid turned 17, graduated from high school with honors, and tried to go to college, he was denied admission. He was deemed an illegal alien. So we took his case, and he finally did not get admitted to the school of his choice, but he went to Virginia Tech, and that was when I changed firms. So when I came over to Dewey and LaBeouf, I asked if there'd be any way that I could continue assisting this kid who now was admitted at Virginia Tech but with out-of-state tuition, which that meant he and his parents were going to have to run out of money, were going to be running out of money for school at the end of that semester. So not only they allowed me to take that case, and by the way, we got him in-state tuition, but from that started a whole program. And now I'm coordinating with six or seven other attorneys to help other students in that same situation. I was here last year at a similar event, and from the audience, two students volunteered to help us out in this project, and they wrote fine memos, one of which I sent directly to the Attorney General's Office of Virginia, and that was very helpful in getting students in a particular immigration category, temporary protected status, to get in-state tuition from that moment on every year, about 200 students in the state every year. So definitely a lot of good can be done for a lot of people who, but for our work, would not be able to go to college. And I'm sure you may not appreciate it right now, but that you will agree one day that going to college and going to law school was really one of the best things you did in your life. So that's what I do. Thanks.
My name is Kate Brennan. I'm a fifth-year corporate associate in the New York office of Dewey and LaBeouf. I actually graduated from UVA Law with Scott in 2003. My pro bono work has focused in the past on child custody and support matters. We're basically partnered. There's a nonprofit organization in New York called In Motion, and they partner indigent women with attorneys in major law firms, women who are seeking custody and child support for their children. And they partner you with attorneys, and they provide support for the attorneys, and they serve as a resource because clearly family law is not my area of expertise. And we actually go into court and litigate in family court for these women on behalf of them with respect to child custody and support matters. That's been my primary focus on pro bono work, but I do some other stuff, which I think I'll talk about a little bit later.
Gotcha. And I have so many stories that I could share. So many stories, but
it goes both ways.
Inappropriate
so,
for a panel discussion.
If anyone wants to talk about Scott after the panel, I'll be over here.
I also have wonderful stories about some of the other panelists too. Aradanya, and I will say this because I told her I was going to embarrass her, just made partner, and I actually worked for her as a summer associate when she was a third year. And to this day, I think was the only day that I was called into the office on a Sunday. And so it's payback time. Ari, we're going to start with an arithmetic problem right now. Two trains are leaving now. So basically, let's start by talking about why law firms are even engaged in pro bono work. Let's start with Delia. I mean, why is it that law firms even care about doing this work?
I think that like some law firms like Dewey and LaBeouf, like we really think that, you know, we have a professional and moral obligation to do pro bono work. Law firms are made up of individuals, and I think we as individuals, would like to think that we're doing work that helps, you know, other people out, and it kind of gives you that feel good. So.
And Ari, what do you think?
Well, I think pro bono work is an investment in the professional development of associates. And what I mean by that is that through pro bono work, associates build the skills that they would not otherwise have the chance to do in a regular litigation. This is mainly the case when you're a junior associate. Having a pro bono case, being able to draft a complaint, answer the complaint, do interrogatories, and just manage the case is the opportunity that you don't really get to have at a big firm until you're a mid-level associate. So having the management skills, also the negotiation skills and the client contact skills is essential for any junior associate to come up, you know, to come through the ranks. I see it more also as an investment for the skills.
I mean, anybody on the panel can chime in on that one. I mean, has anybody gotten to do anything or even known colleagues that got to do things earlier in their career that they probably wouldn't have gotten to do otherwise?
Yeah. In this pro bono case I was mentioning before, last year I was negotiating directly with the head of the education section of the Attorney General's office on the fate of 200 students a year, and I didn't have to go to a partner to ask for approval or anything. I basically was able to negotiate and make an agreement right there on the spot, and we settled the case. We had found a very good student to take his case to court, and the day before the hearing, got this call from the Attorney General's office that they were willing to see things a different way, and I was able to negotiate right there and agree and end the case without talking to a partner about it.
You made them an offer they couldn't refuse.
What?
You made them an offer they couldn't refuse, huh?
No, they made an offer that's what we wanted. And pro bono definitely lets you be in a spot that you probably would not be as an associate. In this group that I'm coordinating of seven attorneys, there are three partners in the group, and I get the chance to kind of not tell them what to do, but kind of tell them what to do. So I think that's a pretty neat thing, you know.
That's enough of a selling point right there. We can end the conference right there. You get to tell partners what to do. As long as we're on you, Luis, I mean, we've talked about, you know, Delia said that there are some firms and some attorneys that absolutely believe that this is just something we have an obligation to do. And Ari, and you just touched on the fact that it allows younger attorneys to do things that they wouldn't normally get to do. What else is out there? What other factors are out there swaying law firms towards pro bono work?
Well, I would say that when you're looking at top-tier law firms like Dewey and LaBeouf, we definitely are paying attention to what is said about us, both in the legal profession, among our clients, and in the law schools that we are going to be recruiting from. And a lot of reviews that law firms get at the top tier, middle tier, have increasingly over the years considered pro bono work as a very important part of how the firm is perceived. If you look, for example, at the American Lawyer, and you see that they take the top firms and then rearrange their ranking based on their pro bono dedication, and they actually have a separate ranking for pro bono. So definitely, pro bono work has become one of the probably three or four main criteria used to rank and evaluate law firms, and that is important for law firms as well.
Say it ain't so.
It's important to ranking? Important to law
firms?
Well,
it is important because, you know, we just care about how we are perceived. And if
right.
you want to be stay on the top, you have to do certain things.
Right. No, it's very true. And you mentioned, I'll just touch on it too, that law schools are part of that the audience that are judging law firms for obvious reasons. Most of my counterparts don't partake in the recruiting efforts as much as I do. I'm actually at every law school hospitality suite and reception that we have on the on-grounds interviewing process.
That's just for the free food, though.
Yes, I have eaten quite a few cheese platters in my life. And I am talking to law school students all the time. As soon as they see me in the hospitality suite and they find out that I have something to do remotely, at least, with pro bono work, it's an automatic conversation starter. It's almost like a release that they get to talk about pro bono work now. And we talk on and on about pro bono work. It's increasingly that way in the on-grounds interviewing process. Law school students are paying attention more and more to pro bono. It's becoming a topic of conversation. It's becoming, quite honestly, I think, from what I know anecdotally, a factor that you all use now to determine what firm you want to go to. So if that's the case, and it may not be the deciding factor, and it may not be the most important factor, but if it is a factor, well, then law firms are going to care about that. They should care about that. Kate, anything else that you want to add?
I think just to follow up briefly on Luis's point is that in addition to how we're perceived by other law firms and by law schools, it's important that pro bono cases are good press for the firm. Outside of the Wall Street Journal, you're probably not going to see much press on the type of deals and cases that we typically handle on a day-to-day basis at the firm. But pro bono cases tend to end up, in the New York Times and in other publications that normally wouldn't pick up law firm business. For example, we had this recent case that we're working with a prospective Olympic athlete who has prosthetic limbs and is being banned from Olympic competition. You know, that was in how many articles that you sent around the other day?
Yeah.
Right? So there's press out there on all these big cases. The Hutto case was followed pretty heavily by the press. None of my pro bono cases have been followed by the press, unfortunately. But there are a lot of high-profile ones that are, and it's important to get your name out there.
Yeah, and it's not even reserved for just the major impact cases. I mean, the ones that Kate just mentioned are very high-profile impact litigations, and if not affecting large groups of people, they're affecting individuals who might have a special status and getting a lot of press. So you might have seen, like, the double amputee trying to get into the Olympics. I mean, that's our pro bono client, and of course, because of him, it's going to draw in press. But even with individual representations, it's the client that drives the story and what is revealing for readers. And I know we had I'm sorry, Luis. Yeah.
No, I just want to add something when you're done.
Yeah, okay. We had a case where, and it wasn't so much a very challenging case legally. It was just a matter of somebody stepping in a very short, time-sensitive situation where we had two kids who were special needs children. Their mother died suddenly. and there was nobody to really take custody of the kids except for this wonderful neighbor who decided to step up and take the kids in. But because the benefits to one of the children was about to expire, somebody had to step up, go to court, argue for an expedited hearing and get it processed and do it. And that's something that we were able to get some press in the New York Law Journal out of. Because it's not because of the work that we necessarily did, but because of the client. I mean, what better client can you think of than that? You know, so that stuff is important to law firms. I mean, we don't want to sugarcoat it and say that the only reason that law firms should care about pro bono work is because it's the right thing to do. We do believe that. But there are other factors, too, in that marketing is something that is important to law firms. So, quite honestly, if we're going to put all the cards on the table, that's a factor that law firms are considering when they're doing pro bono work.
And it's also how paid clients perceive the law firm. And these paying clients oftentimes will read about a story like this and be really engaged in it and be very supportive of the firm. So I think it's...
Right.
Yeah, I was just going to say that it does improve the relationship with your clients. And I'm saying billable clients, like MetLife, Allstate. Those are companies that support a lot of the community-based programs.
Right.
And when they see also that the law firms that they work with support them, it just improves the relationship that they have.
Right.
As well.
Yeah. And Luis, you said?
Yeah, along those lines, I wanted to say we do pro bono because it's the right thing to do. And I think each one of us chooses a pro bono project that is more suited to their personal circumstances. You know, in my case, I'm an immigrant, and that's why I, you know, when I saw this concerted attempts to keep immigrant children from attending college, I thought that was wrong. But, and I never thought about actually using that work for purposes of trying to get business to the law firm. But then when I thought about it, it should help. A lot of the clients that we work with are countries in my practice area. And so I decided to start mentioning to them that we were doing this type of work on behalf of immigrants. And it really opened their eyes, and I think it's made the relationship even better because they know that we care about their own nationals that live here in the United States. Just a month ago, I was at the office of the ambassador of Honduras to present a proposal to represent the government in an international arbitration case. And I know, because he told us that he had two other proposals from two other law firms. I know that we are, you know, definitely better than the other law firms, but just as... As an added incentive, I gave the ambassador a copy of a Washington Post article that said how we had helped nationals of Honduras getting state tuition. And so he looked at us and he said, well, I guess that puts you over the top. So it does help. So it is.
Yeah, get that in writing, so I can.
So right now, tonight I'm supposed to draft the final proposal, and I think we might be getting this case. I'm not saying it's because of that, but it really helps.
Wow.
And it wasn't designed that way, but it just happened. So why not use it?
Wow. So Nancy, why is it important from the perspective of a public interest organization that law firms are in this game?
Well, first of all, and I did forget to mention, I too am a UVA law grad, and it's great to be back and see so many folks here who are interested, and I know there's more, but who are interested and committed to pro bono. But three words, why public interest groups care about law firms, lack of resources. I will never make what a first-year associate makes right now at Dewey and LaBeouf. Never. We don't have any money. And law firms step up and give us not only money and donations, but they give us hours, they give us time. In 2006, the Lawyers Committee, I don't have my hours for 2007 yet, the law firms donated over $13 million worth of pro bono services and another, couple million in paying for depositions and experts and you know, whatnot. The Lawyers Committee, even though we've been around for 45 years, we have a small budget. We have a staff of probably 15 active, litigating, practicing lawyers. And you can imagine the number of cases with impact cases that we could take on with such a small staff. It would not be very many. But because of law firms like Dewey and LaBeouf and like other firms, our docket is about 60 to 70 big cases, let alone the additional 20 impact transactional matters that we take on. So we are really able to help so many more people because of law firms. And, you know, we are somewhat unique among national public interest groups in that we co-counsel with firms on everything that we do, and this was part of our mission when Kennedy created us so many years ago. But it is just unbelievable what firms will do and how they will step up. I used to harass my friends who went to the dark side, you know, went to work for firms, but I don't do that. I've been in my job for 9 years as pro bono counsel, and we would not survive without the law firm support that we get. So,
Nancy just reminded me of a point of, like, how I was bought by Legacy Dewey when I was a summer. Like as I said, I was a court-appointed special advocate, a volunteer before going to law school and that whole thing. And I split my summer, and Dewey donated, like, money towards my CASA program, and I was just like, okay. They bought me.
So you're taking notes?
I'm taking notes, yeah.
So donate to some associates'
right.
causes.
All right, so now for the part of the discussion that I call the meat and the potatoes of the discussion, that is what factors can law school students use to distinguish, I guess, among law firms, when they're trying to split hairs, when they're trying to make those decisions on who to interview with, who to accept offers with, and things like that, if one of the factors that they want to consider is pro bono work. So, Luis, coming back to you again, what is one factor, I guess, that we can use to distinguish?
Well, I guess from personal experience, I can say a big factor, and you were referring to the difference between a law firm allowing pro bono and embracing pro bono. I think it's exactly what their policies are with respect to how much pro bono you can do and how that's going to impact your compensation. I know there are firms that say, we allow you to do pro bono up to so many hours, and they can count towards your billable requirements, which in turn, most law firms also make you qualify for a bonus at the end of the year. The thing is, when you're working on a pro bono case, if you're really embracing the case, you treat that case exactly the same as you would treat a case from a paying client. And if the hours that they allow are 200, for example, and your case is not done, doesn't mean that you're going to drop the case or start doing a lot less work than you were doing before. So I think the law firm shows the commitment on the policies it has. At Dewey and LaBeouf, in my last 2 years, we had guidelines that 200 hours would count automatically, and then if you submitted a request for that you were in the middle of something, they would allow you to do more. Last 2 years, I was in that position where I got to my 200 hours and I still was halfway through, so I asked for another 100, and it didn't take 15 minutes for me to get the answer back, sure. And then I had to ask for another 100, and they said, took 20 minutes, but they said, sure. So I felt the complete freedom to do what I needed to do to finish that case successfully from the firm. You know, it doesn't mean that you're going to do all pro bono and no billable time, because, you know, that's not what we are in the law firm for. And I do enjoy my billable work a lot, so I wouldn't do that. But it just means that the firm is serious, and all that time, when they say they allow it, it's not just that they allow it. They allow it, and that counts towards your billable hour requirements, and so that qualifies you for your bonus if you're going to get one. So I think that's when you look at the bottom line, the financial impact, I think that's when a law firm really shows its commitment to pro bono, is whether they're going to be willing to put their money where their mouth is.
And actually, and just recently, that was actually our policy up until very recently, where we would automatically grant by 200 hours, and then you'd have to come ask me if you wanted to go further. We actually just recently even lifted that limit. But it is important to note what Louise says, and that is not an unlimited ticket to come into a law firm and do as much pro bono as you possibly can with disregarding your billable demands. That's a way of saying that if you're going to a firm that supports it and embraces pro bono work, that they're going to allow you to do as much as long as you're balancing a good amount of your billable work, too. And anybody who tells you differently is not doing you justice. I remember one student at Harvard came up to me last spring and pulled me aside. I'm sorry, last fall, and pulled me aside. And it's like, can you really do just all the pro bono work you want? I was like, oh, young one, let me tell you how it really is. No, you, of course not. But I don't think anybody that is truly looking at law firms and understands how law firms work would expect that you can go into a law firm and bill 500 hours of billable time and 1,500 hours of pro bono work and say, got my 2,000 hours. You know, it doesn't quite work like that. So, but if you are going to a firm that does embrace it, and you do a good amount of bill of work, a good balance of bill of work, and pro bono work gets you over the top for whatever you want that you're supposed to get for your bonus, that firm is going to acknowledge that and honor it. So,
yeah, but there are also some major impact litigation where you have from a junior associate to a senior associate having to put more than 1,000 hours on the case. But it's a major impact litigation, and you need the associate. You can't just, you know, the associate can't just leave the case in the middle of the litigation. So it depends on the case and how big, the case is.
That's absolutely right. And I'd say as advice to folks going into a law firm, you could have one of those cases. I would say that's a once in a career type of case for an associate at the same firm. So in other words, if you're on that case that goes to trial, unbelievable experience. And if you're at a firm that truly embraces pro bono work, they're not even going to bat an eye at you putting in 800 hours or 1,000 hours. We had people, I approved it last year for that. And nobody questions it. But can you do that every year? No, obviously, because then we get back into the same boat that we were just in. So it's just a matter of being smart. You want to, you know, you're trying to build a career, a professional career, and you're going to get some things out of your billable work that you can't get out of your pro bono work, just like you're going to get some things out of your pro bono work that you can't get out of your billable work. You want to balance it. So,
I just want to say something before he goes down the list of the other ways to differentiate between firms. I want to tell you that there really is a difference between firms and how they allow or their pro bono programs. There is a huge difference. I've worked with all the big firms and a lot of smaller firms. So what they're saying is true. So you should listen to all their points very carefully, because when you are selecting firms, if it's important to you to be able to do pro bono work, you have to be careful, because you could end up at a firm where you're not getting credit or you're not getting the experience or this or that. So I just really wanted to emphasize that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Can we cover that at the end, maybe? And then so we'll talk about that. In fact, actually, the reason why we're even having this discussion right now is probably a discussion that you might not feel comfortable having with law firms when you're going to their hospitality suites. But we can. Well, except for me, actually, that's right. You can talk to me all the time. If you see pro bono guy at a hospitality suite, fair game. It's on. You can talk about this stuff. All right. So, Adelia, and Eridania, like, what factors can you come up with that you know we can use to distinguish amongst law firms?
I think there are two main factors that you have to look at and that you have to consider when you are looking at law firms. One is you have to see how the law firms structure the pro bono program, and I'll explain that in a bit. The second factor is you have to see the support within the firm, the support from the leadership of the firm to the administrative level, basically top-down support and participation, which is critical. Now, going back to the first factor on how to how firms structure their pro bono work, I mean, you could tell those firms that have a director of pro bono whose job is full-time job is to really manage the pro bono program. That, to me, it gives me a sense of commitment from the firm, and it also shows me that the firm pro bono work is part of the firm's culture. Now, the second factor, which is the support and participation of the leadership of the firm, I think is very key. And what I mean by that is you need to have the chairman of the firm committed, partners committed by having partners supervise the pro bono cases. You know, pro bono is not only about the development of skills for associates, but it's also about partners being held accountable for supervising those cases. And when you see that support from the top and from every level of the firm, you know, that's, it, I think, is a key factor to consider.
Just one thing to follow up on Aradania's first point was the way our pro bono program was structured at Legacy LaBeouf before Scott became pro bono guy was we had two partners who managed it. And they were both, we were talking about this before, they're both really great people who are very committed to public interest work, but they were partners at the firm who had full billable schedules as well. And so they didn't have the time to necessarily commit to it. So from your perspective, it's going to be hard to see when you're interviewing at a firm or you're looking at their website, are, you know, is the chairman committed? How the hell do I know? But you can look and say, is there a specific person whose job it is to administer a pro bono program? Is that person a, an active partner, or is it an administrative person? And I think if you see that the firm has someone who, on the administration side, is managing pro bono, then it shows that the firm really has a commitment to provide someone who is monitoring pro bono and actively going out and looking for cases and getting attorneys involved.
And the chairman also have, they do have statements, pro bono statements, but not all firms have it. So you have the chairman of the firm talking about the firm's commitment. And that is in the website of some of the
firms that are
truly committed.
Actually, we just had ours, so I was going to bring copies of it, but it literally just came out Thursday from our chairman with a pretty strong statement. Kate, can you talk a little bit about the whole like fellowship externship angle?
Sure, that's another thing that you can probably find on a firm's website. Pretty sure that it's on ours. If it's not, it should be.
It is. And it's in the brochures, too, as well. Plenty of merchandising here for you.
So, a lot of firms have different externship programs, which enable you to actually go out into the community and work at a nonprofit or at a DA's office doing public interest work full-time for a couple of months. I know at the combined Dewey and LaBeouf firms, at least in New York, we have three externships. One is at South Brooklyn Legal Services, where you go and you do housing law, and you handle your own caseload, and you're actually actively litigating on a daily basis. Another one is with, I think, Brooklyn DAs.
Mm-hmm.
It's Brooklyn DA's office, and that's the same thing. You carry your own caseload. You're supervised by attorneys there doing criminal prosecution. And then there's a transactional opportunity, externship opportunity with Lawyers Alliance, where you do transactional work with nonprofit entities. Those are three externships that the combined firm of Dewey and LaBeouf have in New York for associates. In addition, we have an externship available to summer associates. Well, actually, we have two things. One is the ability to split your summer between working at the firm and working at a nonprofit. Once you're given an offer, you can apply for this split summer program. I did it when I was a summer associate, and I split my time with Lawyers for Children and did child advocacy work in Lower Manhattan for half of my summer and was paid summer associate salary by LaBeouf the whole time, which was great. In addition to that actual split summer program, which I think we offer to a couple of associates on an application basis every summer, we also have a couple of externships that are 1 week and 2 week externship opportunities for summer associates in nonprofit agencies. I'm not sure exactly what those are, if they change from year to year.
Yeah, it's a host.
So you can usually find information about a firm's externship commitments and opportunities on their pro bono website and probably also on their summer associate pages.
Right. We were also going to touch on awards and recognitions, but for time, I'm just going to skip over that, just with the exception of saying that three out of the four people on the panel just happened to be award recipients last year of our own internal awards. The reason why it's important to look at some of those is a firm that truly recognizes its own attorneys is another factor, another thing to consider in determining whether the firm really appreciates it. Do they put people up on a pedestal for their pro bono work and send news blasts out about pro bono victories and award people and give them things? Also, external awards, something to look at. Are organizations honoring the firm for doing pro bono work? Something to look at. That should definitely be on firm websites, but if not, ask the pro bono person at that firm, what kinds of recognitions have you gotten, have you received from organizations? Then, I mean, Luis and Nancy, I mean, maybe you can touch on the high-profile impact types of matters and how that distinguishes some firms from each other.
Well, two things just quickly before we get to that. One way to differentiate, we mentioned the American Lawyer earlier. Definitely look at those hours. I didn't want to make sure that we didn't forget that. It's a monthly magazine, a big glossy thing. July in the last couple of years has been the pro bono issue. Look at the hours. Look at the firms that are in the top rankings, as well as the A-list, and that's usually in the same issue. The A-list pro bono is counted twice, as well as, I think, profits per partner. So that does show a huge amount. And the other thing you can do to differentiate between firms is, 99% of us UVA law alums loved law school, which makes us more open and to receiving phone calls and emails from law students. We'll tell you. We'll be honest. You can email Scott. You can email me, even if you're thinking of going to Covington. Is that a good pro bono firm? We'll be honest and tell you, but I wanted to make sure and mention those before we forgot. In terms of the lawyers' committee in high profile matters and how you can tell whether a firm counts or not or cares or not about pro bono, the firms that work on our cases spend a lot of money. We had a firm last year who we sued FEMA after Katrina 2 years ago, $1.4 million on a case. That was just an attorney time, and I think like $500,000 in expenses. If the firm wasn't committed to pro bono, they wouldn't be willing to do that because that's just a lot of money and a lot of time. So they definitely would not do that. And the other thing in terms of the high-profile cases is they're frequently controversial, both inside the firm and outside the firm. Law firms are made up of people on both the left and the right side of the playing field, and our cases may be viewed as being more on the left. And the folks on the right, they'll have huge fights over whether they want to take this on, but firms that take on the big cases show that they really are committed. And while publicity is great for cases, sometimes, it's not necessarily so great because, again, it's a controversial case, and the firms recognize that may happen. But, again, their willingness to take on these big cases, and you can tell from websites whether they've taken on these big cases, shows a lot about their commitment to pro bono.
Yeah, I think that was great. There's not much to add except that on the high-profile cases, those are going to be cases where a lot of hours are going to be demanded. And if a law firm is really not so serious about pro bono, they're going to try to do the smaller things, but really not want to take the bigger cases where there's going to be a bigger commitment in hours, and that's definitely something that you really need to take into account.
Right, and that's not to diminish the importance of the individual representation matters. Those are absolutely critical, and there's some people who actually shy away from the impact work because they like to have one client, they like to change the life of one client at a time and know that they prevented them from being evicted or got their child services that are on their IEP but the school district isn't providing. And those are wonderful cases, and we do that as well. I think the point is that some people like to be engaged with the large impact work, though. And if you're one of those people, you have to pay attention to whether the firms that you're considering are okay with going in that direction, whether they get engaged with those types of matters. And if they don't, that might be a factor as to whether or not you're going to enjoy the pro bono work that firm can provide.
Sometimes you can do both at the same time. Like, for example, on this big decision last year that we got, we're taking an individual case. But from that case, we're challenging what the rationale was for everybody else in the state. So with that one case, we were able to change it, not just, and with him, we're at an individual basis, but through his decision, change it for everyone, and to me, that's a big multiplier.
So. Absolutely. That's the best of both worlds. Yeah. You know, you get to change the life of individual students and then change the status.
Help everybody else.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so moving away from distinguishing amongst the firms, isn't it true that pro bono work is really run by litigators? I mean, isn't it really a litigator's heaven? And are transactional attorneys really engaged in pro bono work?
I could speak to that.
Sure, go for it.
I'm a transactional attorney, and I do pro bono work, and none of it happens to be litigation. And, you know, like as I mentioned earlier, they're the clinics that you can work on, you know, do an intake and that sort of thing. There's also some research that you can do to help organizations, and I know like in the tax group, you know, helping to incorporate certain nonprofit entities, you know, I worked on a DC housing authority matter for a woman that was being threatened to be evicted and that kind of thing. So there's some administrative litigation that you could do, and I'm corporate energy, and so I do administrative litigation. You know, as a transactional attorney, you can have a lot of impact.
I'll just add briefly to that as a corporate associate, you can also take on litigation cases. I do a lot of my child support and child custody matters are all litigated in family court. And the reason I didn't go into litigation is because I hate research, not necessarily because I hate standing in front of a judge. So it's great for me because I don't, you know, there's not a huge body of family law that's out there. So there's not that much research involved, but you still get to advocate on the behalf of a client in front of a referee, typically in a family court setting. But there are also plenty of transactional pro bono opportunities, and I know that Luis mentioned that a lot of times the pro bono work that we get comes out of personal experience or personal causes. And just as a quick example of that, after a friend who graduated with us from law school was diagnosed with cancer, she started going to an organization called I'm Too Young for This.org, which provides support and resources to cancer survivors under 40. And we now act as their outside legal counsel, and I do all their corporate governance matters, and I advise their board on different corporate matters.
Right.
So there are plenty of transactional opportunities out there as well.
That's right, and I think that was actually awarded. That organization was like shouted out by Time magazine, right?
Yeah, they were exactly.
Like on the top.
They've been getting
50.
A lot of yeah. Awards lately.
Yeah, and that's true also with some very sophisticated transactional clients. It's another direction that law firms sometimes choose to go in is to go after, like Teach for America and Donors Choose, as a couple examples of our clients, because they provide. I mean, these are organizations that are not startup not-for-profits, you know, by two people in the back of a room. I mean, these are organizations that started out that way, but have grown over the last 10, 15, 20 years to become incredibly sophisticated clients that have sophisticated problems. So they have issues that involve corporate work, tax work, IP work, insurance work, employment work, and it allows some of our senior attorneys who wouldn't normally want to shoot off to family court or to housing court, they can actually stay in the box and do what they normally do, but they do it for a not-for-profit client instead of a fee-paying client. So it's an interesting way to kind of provide opportunities. And that's basically the point. A pro bono program for a law firm that is truly solid provides opportunities for all types of attorneys, no matter whether they're transactional or litigators or administrative people. It provides kind of all across the board. There are transactional attorneys that want to do litigation, and there's litigators that want to do transactional work. But there's litigators who want to go to court, and there's transactional attorneys that want to deal with not-for-profit clients. There's also, as far as the diversity of the opportunities, you also want to capture long-term and very short-term opportunities, because not every person wants a 2-year court case. Some people want a 2 hours on Thursday night, the third week of the month, you know, something like that. And I do you like, you participate in one of those programs. Maybe you
right.
can talk about that. I mean,
because I do the clinics because and the CASA work because I can do the CASA work on my own time. You know, it's very flexible because my day job is very demanding. And you know, if I've got to respond to a complaint in a FERC docket, like, it's time sensitive. I can't be pulled off for, like you said, 2 years, and so I've got to get my 2,000 hours, and then my pro bono is on top of that. So it's easy for me to kind of fit in and to schedule around a four-hour clinic on the third Friday of the month. So that works for me.
Right. And Nancy, like some of the work that you do, like election protection work, probably fits into that category too. It's
Yeah. I mean, we have a national voter protection program that, you know, another panel I was on with doing LaBeouf folks, one of the partners who just, you know, volunteered for 4 hours to answer the phones, folks who were having problems with voting. So there are lots of transactional opportunities out there, especially in the last 10 years. They've increased tremendously. So it's not just for litigators.
Right. I will open up to questions, but I do want to make sure that I get to Dean Emery's point about the recruiting process. And panelists, feel free to chime in with this. I guess the biggest question is when do you ask questions, and what types of questions do you ask to find out the answers to the questions that we've been talking about today? And I can certainly provide my own opinion about it, but it's just an opinion. And Kate tells me often that nobody wants to hear my opinion. So so basically, I mean, my own opinion is that, you know, in your 20-minute on-grounds interview, it could be risky to bring up pro bono, but I think it's worth the risk. You just have to do it in a very casual way. I mean, you got 20 minutes to convince the person across the desk from you that you're the right fit for the firm. And you need to do whatever you need to do in order to convince them of that. They're also doing the same thing. They're trying to convince you that this firm is the right spot for you. And if pro bono is important to you, then in my opinion, there's nothing wrong with weaving that in. I wouldn't make it the first thing you talk about. I wouldn't say, hi, my name is Scott Fishman. Let me hear about your pro bono work. You know, not exactly that way. I mean, it's something that maybe you can even just ask a quick question and say, you know, at 10 minutes into the interview, oh, you know, also one thing I wanted to mention, you know, something that's very important to me in my background is public interest work and pro bono work. Maybe you can put me in touch with the person in your firm so I can follow up later on to find out a little bit more about what type of pro bono opportunities you have. What that does is two things. One, if they look at you and they have absolutely no idea who runs pro bono at the law firm, I think you have your answer. Second, if it allows you to say that it's important to you, but then remove it from the interview so that you're not wasting the only 20 minutes you have all talking about pro bono. It could also alleviate the opportunity if the person across the table happens to be a strong advocate of pro bono. Well, it probably will just spark off the conversation. You all will hit it off there, and you'll get Aradania across from you, and Aradania will sit there and tell you all about the Hutto case and what a great job that, you know, that she did on it, and how you would have loved to be part of the team if you just come to the firm. You know, so it could be, and I think that's the smartest way to kind of fit it in. If you don't feel comfortable fitting it in 20 minutes, there's nothing wrong with that. But do make sure you stop by the hospitality suite and find out information about it from whoever's there, whatever recruiting people they send. Make sure you get the name of somebody that you can contact. And if they can't provide a single name that is responsible for coordinating the pro bono efforts, if they say, oh, maybe you should talk to Susie. Susie does a lot of pro bono. Wrong answer. You know, you got to have somebody that actually has the job 100% that coordinates it. And if it's a partner, that might also tell you, according to some of the information that Aradania said, if it's a partner that's responsible for coordinating the efforts, that might be an indicator that it doesn't get done the way it needs to get done. There should be a full-time coordinator who's it could be an attorney. I'm an attorney. But it should not be somebody who is part-time pro bono. You gotta find somebody who has, most of the major firms have caught on to that. So most of the major firms have somebody that coordinates a full-time.
I do disagree with Scott on something.
Okay.
And
never.
That is risky. It could be risky to ask about pro bono. But I disagree with that. I think law firms recognize that pro bono, as Luis was saying, is one of the key factors that students are looking at. So it's one of the key factors by which firms get ranked. And just asking the question openly about a firm's pro bono work just shows also your interest for the work. Remember that in those 20 minutes for the interview, if you are there, it's because you have the qualities. You have the what it takes to be an associate at a firm. So it's not only you trying to convince the firm, but the firm also has to convince you that that is the firm that is right for you. So I will be open about the questions. Yes, I wouldn't make my 20 minutes all about pro bono, but if you're interested in it, ask it. Yeah. Always do research, though, on the firms and what they do. And I would just ask the questions based on the research you've done about it.
But, I mean, I think that the fear is that the person across from the table is the one partner in the firm who doesn't really care anything about pro bono. I mean, and
if it's a CVA grad, you don't have a problem.
Right. There you go. I mean, and it's true. I mean, there are you could have the opinion, well, if the person dings me for asking about pro bono, it's the wrong firm. I don't want to be there. And that sounds good. It might even be the right call for you, but that might be too extreme. You know, you might just be talking to one partner in a firm that really does support pro bono, but it just happens to be that that partner is the one that they sent to do your interview, and they personally weren't involved with pro bono, and they might ding you for it. You have to make that. I mean, I can't tell you when exactly to bring it up. You have to do what's most comfortable for you. If I were in your position, I would bring it up, because I do agree with Aradania, as I do 99% of the time, that it's a worthwhile risk. It is a risk, but it's a worthwhile risk if pro bono work at a law firm is important for you. And I would bring it up, and I would bring it up casually in a way that I can kind of talk about it, touch on it, but then remove it and then talk about it later with other people.
Scott, I'd just like to add one point to that, you know, before you go into these interviews, you would normally, at least I did, you would be able to review that partner's profile, if you will, on the website, and see whether or not they're interested in pro bono. And so you would know who you're dealing with, I would think, to some extent. If it's an associate, which, you know, some firms, you know, send out associates, I don't think associates are, you know, shy about talking about pro bono in general. So you can bring it up, but definitely, like, if you bring it up with me, then, like, 10 minutes of your time does get wasted, I think, talking about pro bono. So that I do think it is a danger, because I can go on and on about pro bono and then not hear about you for 10 minutes. But the other thing is that we do, and most firms do, is have the literature available so that you don't have to spend too much time on it. You just grab the externship pamphlet, and you grab the pro bono information in general, which will have like the awards and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's also helpful if you don't want to talk about it, so you'll have written information.
Right. And I did mention it before, on the callback interview phase, definitely bring it up. And you're going to be meeting with six people. I think that's the best way to kind of get a feel. You ask everybody about pro bono. You see what kind of responses you get from each of them. You get a little bit of a better cross-section of the firm. And you should request of the recruiting people when you go back for the callback interview that somehow in that rotation you speak to the pro bono coordinator. Somehow.
And this is the one piece of advice I've heard from Scott's peers. Don't ask the Scotts of the world, though, how they got their jobs, because I've had several of them say, like, I was doing these interviews and I loved them, but all they kept doing was talking about my job, and it was, like, obvious that all they wanted to do was pro bono and not bill any, and they asked him, so.
They wanted his job.
And they wanted his job. That's right.
Everybody wants Scott's job.
Oh, there are a lot of haters, yeah. There are a lot of haters. All right, well, I definitely want to make sure that you guys have ample time to ask us questions that we might not have covered. I mean, we tried to think ahead of what questions you would ask so that we hit them all during the discussion itself, but we might have missed some. So, yes?
With regards to what you're saying about like profiles and bios and stuff, do you think that there is a real difference on firms' websites and whether they promote it on people's profiles and bios? Like, you know, this person was involved with such and such a firm or receiver or something like that. Is there,
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, because I've looked at a lot of firm sites when I'm trying to, you know, look up a partner I'm meeting with or something, and, you know, some of the firms that are great pro bono, they don't have tons on their website about pro bono. I don't know why, and their bios won't even mention that they're the pro bono partner or, you know, they're on the pro bono committee or something. And some firms won't even mention that they have a pro bono position on their website. So, you know, don't completely judge a book by its cover. But then again, there's firms who have these great pro bono websites and they do squat. So, you know, there's no magic answer.
I have to completely agree. In fact, I would go stronger and say it's almost not even worth spending too much time on the website at all.
Other than they may have their pro bono brochure posted.
Yeah. I mean,
and so that's where you can see their externships, the awards they've received.
Yeah. So. That's basically what you get. Just like, I mean, like I said, we have materials here for you, and we have our most recent pro bono profile. We don't have our brochure yet, because after we merge, obviously, we have to redo all those materials. But we have a very small pit that talks about the policy, kind of like an overview of the type of work that we do very briefly, and then blurbs about maybe 6-7 different recent accomplishments. It has our awards and all the organizations we work with. So there's a lot of information there, but that doesn't really tell you the answers to the questions that we were talking about today. So you got to have a discussion in person or over the phone with an actual live person. The vault, NALP, American Lawyer, they all give you very good information. They give you like little nuggets of information. They give you average hours. So you'll find out that if you go, you know, if you look under our firm in the next vault or NALP, whenever it decides to come out, you'll find out that we had 80,000 hours in an average. If you look at American Lawyer, our average hours are like 99 hours per attorney. Does that tell you something? Yeah, it does. Does it tell you whether we do impact work versus individual representation? Does it tell you how many hours that we credit for bonus purposes? Does it tell you whether we have a full-time pro bono person? No. But it does tell you that obviously there are a lot of attorneys doing good work there. So if you want to, like, as a first kind of cutoff, if you want to see if a firm is even doing pro bono work at all, I would look at the NALP and the vault because they're great. I mean, all the firms are pretty much in there. You just flip on the page and they have to all answer the same questions. They give you blurbs about the, you know, a couple different cases that they have. They give you participation stats and things like that. Look at them. If you see a firm has an average of 10 hours per attorney, you know that that's a firm that's not even doing that much pro bono work. You don't even have to go further and try to talk to a pro bono coordinator. But if you see, you know, that if you narrow it down to like 5 firms that you're considering and they're all in that, you know, 60, 70, 80 hours of average per attorney, you know that they're doing some good work. Then you got to go deeper and then get off the website and talk to pro bono people, talk to attorneys. I mean, recruiting people are great. Use them. They can put you in touch with people who are doing work. They should know. So.
Any suggestions with smaller firms?
No.
So, any ideas?
Exclusive coordinators may not, but I know that some smaller firms actually do have somebody that that does take it on administratively, specifically, because we've actually coordinated with some smaller firms in anticipation of some cases coming up, and I've talked to some of my colleagues out there with small firms. The game is so different. The game is so different. Some firms do very well, actually, with pro bono because they might only have one office. They are embedded in the community. So they take on a few big projects or maybe several smaller projects for individuals in the community, and everybody in the office participates. So if you were to look at their stats, they might have 100% participation, and they might all do, you know, 20, 30 hours, 40 hours worth of work. But the kind of machine that you're looking for is probably not going to exist at a smaller firm for the obvious reasons. But I think there are distinctions, though, between small firms that could care less about pro bono and small firms that do care about pro bono. And I think that I'm not sure when in the process you'd want to bring that up, but I think you should before you make the decision to go there. I would actually talk to as many in a small firm. It's easy to get a real grip, you know, on whether it's embraced or not by talking to 5-6 people and say, do you do any? You know, what kind of work have you done? How long ago did you do it? That's a good question to ask. Oh, boy.
My husband, who's a UVA law grad as well, he's at a small plaintiff's firm, and they have 3 Guantanamo Bay cases, which is a huge deal. So there are small firms that do it. And one thing that came up when we did this panel at Penn, not everyone's going to go to D.C., New York, or San Francisco, where there's a lot of the big firms and where there's the strongest pro bono culture by far. Chicago, Atlanta, you know, they're getting there, but... You know, Houston, none. You know, New Orleans, not so much. St. Louis, that's, you know, none. But one thing, if you end up in any of those other cities, not one of those big cities, you know, one thing to consider is that you maybe don't go to the, you know, big, huge Fulbright and Jaworski in Houston, but you look at whether there are any of these big New York firms that do tons of pro bono. Do they have a small office in Houston or in Miami or, you know, wherever you're going? Mm-hmm. You know, L.A., they don't do so much pro bono, but if you go to Duane LaBeouf there, even though it's a smaller office, you'll get to do tons of pro bono because that culture is throughout the firm, no matter what city you're in. Mm-hmm. And you will get the support of the firm, even if you're in a city that doesn't have such the strong pro bono culture. So, you know, the smaller offices in other cities are definitely something to consider, and quiz the folks at the firms, whether at the smaller firms, if they do it.
Yeah. Question is, what is it with, like, Atlanta and Chicago? What's going on in these cities?
You know, Atlanta's definitely changing since I've been at the Lawyers Committee. But, I mean, some of it you could say, like in Texas, for example, is the chicken and the egg syndrome. I mean, there's not tons of public interest groups banging on the doors with the pro bono opportunity. So it's, you know, if you're a lawyer working full-time, it's hard to come up with your own pro bono matters. But then on the other hand, they're not doing the work, so there's no demand for these public interest groups. I don't know, but there is a, you know, a huge difference between, I mean, New York and D.C.,
I can tell you what it's not. It's not that there's not people in need.
Right.
You know, that is clear. So, I mean, and it's true because, you know, we have a Houston office and I have a lot more difficulty finding cases out there. I just found some not-for-profit work in Houston, which was more challenging than I thought it was going to be. There wasn't even a concise, like, place to go where I could even find out the organizations that do it. It just took a lot of research and Googling and calling people and,
you know. Which is another one of the benefits of going, like, with Dewey and LaBeouf in Houston, for example, that if you were a litigator, there may not be any big cases there with the public interest group, but, you know, they'll put you on the case up in, you know, wherever in Missouri that they've got, even though they don't have an office there. So you could still end up with, you know, really good pro bono opportunities in other parts of the country with other offices. So,
yeah. Good point. Like the Missouri Voting Rights Act case?
That's right.
We had a Missouri Voting Rights case with the Lawyers Committee. good selection. Good example.
St. Louis firms to work with us and with Dewey doing our case.
That was a great case, too. Any other questions? None. Silence the crowd. That's it. It's done. All right, guys. Thank you very much. And thank you for the panel.
Thank you, panelist Scott, for coming out again. And if you have questions, I'm sure Scott's happy to have emails. And likewise, maybe the rest of the panelists, too. And encourage you to start getting involved with some of this now. It's a good way to tell which direction you might want to go. And there are firms that are out there sponsoring law student projects, both as in your summer associate and throughout the year as Louis was saying. So, thank you.
Thank you. And get some food on the way out.